This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Today, we're pulling back the curtain on one of the most disturbing, most closely watched murder cases in recent American memory. The brutal slayings of four college students in Moscow, Idaho, and the alleged killer now etched in the national psyche, Brian Koberger. We don't have to say alleged anymore. He is the killer. But this isn't just a conversation about what happened. It's about what still does not add up. What remains buried beneath press conferences, courtroom formality, and tidy timelines that fail to explain the why. Because behind the crime scene photos and the cell tower pings, there's a far messier, more human story unfolding. One that involves a broken family, a faltering legal defense, and a psychological spiral that few of us can begin to comprehend. Joining me today are two guests uniquely equipped to cut through the noise. First, Howard Bloom, award-winning investigative journalist, New York Times best-selling author, and the man who's broken some of the most important stories in the case, and has also discussed some of the bombshell details that have come out, originally broken by Dateline, discussing 6 a.m. phone call, technically 5:54 a.m., that Brian Koberger made to his family less than 2 hours. Let that sink in. Less than 2 hours after the murders, bright and sunny in the morning, he's calling mom and dad. Have a nice little conversation. Holidays are coming up. What's on your list? The phone registered to his father is where that call went to. A call that, if you ask, Bloom changed everything. He's also the author of When the Night Comes Falling, a searing exploration of the case that functions as both a crime narrative and a requiem. And joining us also, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent and former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Robin brings a surgical eye to behavior, kind that sees meaning in every deviation, every misplaced reaction, every nervous tick. When people's stories don't match their pattern, Robin spots it. So, together, we're going to be unpacking the psychological chaos around this case, the fear, denial, the quiet unraveling inside the Koberger home. We're talking about remorse, or something like it, maybe, and what happens when people closest to a killer begin putting two and two together too late to stop anything, but maybe just in time to realize they've been protecting a lie. It all begins with that early morning phone call, the one nobody knew about until Bloom's reporting and Dateline made it public, a call between Brian Koberger and his family. It just might have been the first real crack in the facade. So I start by asking Howard, what exactly was said on that call? And why did it matter so damn much?
First, we should remember that Koberger, and now we can say Koberger, not the alleged killer, Koberger left the house on King Road at 4:20 in the morning. Now at 5:54 in the morning, less than 2 hours later, he is, according to Dateline, which first broke this story, he's making a call to a phone registered to his father, Michael Koberger. Mm-hmm. That is, again, just 2 hours after the murder, approximately. What was said? Only Brian Koberger and to whomever he spoke with, only they know what was said. However, my reporting has revealed that he was largely talking on that conversation with his mother, Marianne Koberger. And this becomes significant when we look to the evolution of the plea deal. Early on, I've been told that Ann Taylor, Koberger's legal aid lawyer, was realizing, oh my gosh, my client really is guilty. And even worse, I'm not going to be able to raise reasonable doubt in a jury, and my client is going to have to face the long guns of a firing squad. And that scared her. So she approaches Koberger and says, let's cut a plea deal. Koberger calls his parents, and his mother says no. She just does not want her son to plead guilty, whether she thought she was innocent, whether she did not want to face the realization that he could be guilty at that moment. For whatever reason, she says no, and so they nix the plea deal. Then, in June, towards the middle of June, the Koberger team tries two Hail Mary passes. They try to convince the judge that they have alternate perpetrators, that Koberger was really the patsy in this whole case, that other people were the murderers. They planted a knife sheath there that had Koberger's DNA in it. And they even file a motion with the judge naming these four people. And the judge reads this motion, Judge Hippler, and he says, not so fast. This is circumstantial evidence at best. It's allegations, not evidence. So that's thrown out. Mm-hmm. Then there's alibi defense. That's their second Hail Mary pass. They want people to think that Koberger was off in a wilderness park in Washington State at 4 a.m. on a freezing, cloudy night stargazing. And the judge looked at this quote-unquote evidence, and he says, that alibi is not an alibi. So now they had no alibi defense. They had no alternative perpetrator theory they could introduce and no alibi. So they approach Koberger again and said, look, for your own sake, to save you from the firing squad, which is the rule in Idaho, you really should consider cutting a deal. Let us go, give us permission to go to the prosecution, see if we can cut a deal. Koberger once again calls up his parents. However, this time, his parents realize after the Dateline special that revealed the call that they might have to go on the stand, his mother might have to go on the stand and talk about what was said during that 54-minute phone call less than 2 hours after the murders. Koberger now realizes that his parents could be put in a position, if they're asked probing questions, that would legally incriminate them. It also becomes clear to the parents that the father would now certainly have to testify about his cross-country trip with his son in the weeks after the murder, where they're sitting shoulder to shoulder in a white Hyundai Elantra while all the police all over the country are looking for a suspect in a white Hyundai Elantra. And Michael Koberger, the father, might have to explain under oath what was said. So when Koberger realizes that not only has he ruined his parents' life, but he might put them in legal jeopardy, he feels a sense of something akin to remorse.
Yeah.
Well, let's not talk about remorse for him. I mean, that's too specific an emotion. His emotions are much more complicated. And you know, I only got a B- in Psych 1 in college. I wouldn't be the one to be an authority on that. But he decides that he owes his parents a duty to try to prevent them from putting themselves on the stand and incriminating themselves. And also, at the same time, he'll be able to save his own life, live out his future in prison, where he'll be able to scheme and dream. So he then tells Ann Taylor, okay, see if you can get me a deal. Ann Taylor goes to the prosecution, to Bill Thompson, who's leading the case. And Thompson, for reasons that befuddle me, leave me completely baffled, agrees. He's holding all the cards. Now, it's never a sure thing. Any veteran prosecutor will tell you that you're going to win. You're always rolling the dice when you go into the courtroom. However, he was holding all the cards. And what I believe happened is that Thompson just lost the appetite for the fight.
Yeah.
He said enough already. He was ready to go fishing. And when you think about it, all the powers that be in Idaho from the very beginning have been so ready, so eager to move on. I mean, first you had Judge, the original judge in the case. And Judge said, all right, take the case up north to Boise. Let's get rid of it. And as soon as they did, he retired from the bench. He didn't want to follow the case there. He had had enough. Then there was Chief Fry, who would run the investigation. He appeared on the news the night of the arrest, teary-eyed. But then in the aftermath, he retired from the police department. He quit. He had enough at working for Moscow. He's now working for a Washington State Police Department. Then there was even Judge Hippler. On this first day that he comes to the court, that he's taking over this case, he begins by addressing everyone, saying, I'd like to tell you I'm happy to be here, but why begin with a falsehood? Mm-hmm. And most tellingly at all, you have the University of Idaho authorities. They couldn't wait to tear down the murder house. They wanted to demolish it, make believe it would go away. The people would stop thinking about it, out of sight, out of mind. And I think that's been the mindset of the honorable men who've been running the state of Idaho, making these decisions about how the case would proceed forward.
I want to go to Robin here in a second, but I want to ask you one more quick question. Robin Dreeke, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Unit, with us as well. I didn't introduce you at the very beginning, but I want to ask you one quick question before I go to you, Robin, on this. Do you think, Howard, that there was incriminating things said on that phone call with the parents? Maybe not necessarily, hey, I killed a bunch of kids today, but maybe if they look back on it retrospectively, there might have been some little nuggets that would have made them raise their eyebrows.
From what I've been able to ascertain, the parents came off that phone call and began to think, oh my gosh, what is going on? Something is wrong with our son. And later when they found out about the murders in the aftermath, they saw his strange behavior when he came home for Christmas, you know, packing his garbage in plastic bags to conceal the DNA, his obsessively cleaning his car. They began to, in their minds, begin to put two and two together. Mm-hmm. And yet they still were reluctant, as I guess any parent might be, to confront the reality that my son, my child, is a monster.
Yeah. I can't imagine. Robin?
Yeah, Howard, thank you so much for, as we said before we even started, for everything you've done and the deep dive and depth of field you have on this case. You started right out from the get-go of identifying a massive behavior spike right after the murders. And that's what that phone call was, whether it's to his mom or dad, you know, that early in the morning, because all of us have these arcs. I call them behavior arcs. And behavior arcs become extremely predictable for people's behavior, past, present, and future, unless there's something that happens that causes a major deviation. And from the way you laid it out, it sounds like that phone call early in the morning was a massive deviation from what he normally did, regardless of that content of their conversation. That was a deviation and something caused it. And then you had all these other data points and deviations in his behavior that his parents are picking up. Notably, you did say, you know, parent of two adult children as well, we want to assume the best. We don't want to turn, you know, we want to turn a blind eye. What do you think kept them so staunch in that he's innocent? Even like you're saying, even when the mother was battling to say he's innocent, when all the data points were just lining up against him.
I think on some level, it's akin to you get a diagnosis from a doctor. And you just don't want to confront it. And I think your insights about his behavior that morning are particularly interesting, because look what happened after that. After that phone call, he then pretty much immediately gets in his car and returns to the house on King Road, either to see if he can get his knife back, this we'll never know, or was he just wanting to see if they had been alerted? And then he drives back to his apartment in Washington State, and he takes that now infamous selfie with the thumbs up. That's sort of self-congratulatory. But I think those three events, the phone call, driving back to the house on King Road, and the selfie are part of one whole of Kohlberger's processing just what he did hours before at 4 a.m.
There is something especially chilling about the moments that almost happen. The plea deal that almost went through, the family members who almost admitted what they were starting to suspect, the chance at justice that almost looked like a trial. What the conversation really revealed is the difference between legal guilt and emotional reckoning. Yes, Kohlberger pled guilty. Yes, the evidence was overwhelming, but what Howard's reporting laid bare and what Robin helped us decode is how looking at it in a different way, how long it took even the people closest to Brian to see him for what he actually is, and how far they were willing to go to deny it. The 6 a.m. phone call wasn't just a timestamp on a call log. It was a psychological flare. And the fact that it went to his parents and that his mother allegedly took the lead on that conversation shifts how we interpret everything that came after. The refusal to take the first plea, the fear of testifying, the sudden shift after the Dateline special. It wasn't just about strategy, it was about damage control, because once that call became public, the spotlight widened to include them. And then there's this deeper pattern. Idaho officials who didn't seem to want to see this case through. Judges retiring, police chief stepping down. A prosecution team, as Howard put it, that may have just lost the appetite for the fight. And maybe that's the most disturbing part of all. Not that the system failed, but that it flinched. That when justice needed the long haul, the state chose convenience. Robin made a sharp point, too. Behavior leaves clues in Brian's arc from the phone call to the return to the crime scene to the now infamous selfie. Was one long behavioral red flag. The kind that only you really see clearly when you stop making excuses for people. So where does it leave us? A man in prison, four families without answers, and a haunting sense that some truths may never make it to the record. But thanks to voices like Howard's and Robin's, at least we're still asking the hard questions.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Brian Koberger.
We have covered a lot of dark territory on this show, but this moment, this was different. This was bone deep. Cousin Brian Koberger stood up in the courtroom, hands stiff at his sides, dead-eyed, emotionless. And look, I'm going to say it because no one else has. I think he had a hard-on. Yeah. Add that to the fucking sick mix of all this. And confessed to murdering four innocent college students. It wasn't a breakdown. It wasn't remorse. It wasn't even really a plea. It was a performance. And the vibe, absolutely chilling. That's the thing about evil that hides in plain sight. It doesn't always announce itself with fireworks. Sometimes it shows up in a courtroom wearing khakis, speaking softly and saying, "Yes, I did it." Like he's ordering off a fast food menu. No hesitation, no pain, just cold, methodical, mechanical confirmation. And it left the room frozen. In this episode, I'm going to sit down with defense attorney Bob Motta, someone who's been inside the system, represented the worst of the worst, and knows the weight of someone like this better than anyone. We break down not just the courtroom scene, but what comes next. The sentencing hearing that's now looming, July 23rd. Will Koberger speak again? Will he pull a BTK-style confession and revel in the retelling? Or will he stay silent, soaking in the infamy he's already secured? And let's talk about that, because for someone like Koberger, prison might not feel like punishment. The box might feel like home. There's no guarantee this man feels isolation the way we would. No guarantee he processes justice, pain, or loss like any normal human being. And that's the unsettling question we circle around. What is justice for someone who may not be capable of feeling guilt? I want to hear your thoughts in the comments section. Please do leave it on YouTube. Press subscribe wherever you're listening to us. This episode isn't just about a plea. It's about what we do when our justice system gives someone exactly what they wanted, and whether the families and the rest of us are left holding the emotional bill. Let's get into it, starting with Bob's reaction to that moment in that courtroom, and let's be honest, none of us will ever unsee. Do you, it's crazy. Would you have trusted a jury with this case at the end of the day to get it right? Yes. Really?
Yes.
Yeah. You'd have been confident.
I think juries get it right most of the time. And I've said it once and I'll say it a million times, that fucking sheath is just smoking gun evidence.
Yeah.
There is no explanation in the world as to why that sheath with his DNA was found under the girls. Yeah. None.
No.
No, like no one's buying any kind of bullshit they would have tried to cook up. No jury's buying it.
No.
No jury's buying it ever. So yes, I 100% would have trusted. Like, I don't think that's the thing. I know people are saying that, oh, the prosecution didn't have the balls to bring. I don't think that's it. I really don't. I think that there's a lot of things to take into consideration. That small county just saved the taxpayers millions and millions of dollars, because it's not just for the trial. It's for the entire appellate process that takes place after. It has to get paid for by the taxpayers. Mm-hmm. It goes on forever.
Yeah.
For up to two decades or more.
Yeah.
You know, before this guy's executed, he might have died of natural causes before they were able to stick him in front of a firing squad.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that part of it has to be taken into consideration. It's just how the legal process works. The wheels of justice turn very, very slowly. And when you take into consideration all of the factors, the money side of it, the humanity side of it, because when you listen to Matty Mogan's father and you read his statement, he has a very different view.
Yeah.
You know, and it's fascinating to look at it because we're all human beings. We all process grief and trauma differently. We're not the same. None of us are the same. And, you know, for him, he felt the relief. And you know what? That fucking psychopath stood up in court and said, I did these things.
I want to get to that. And you're right. Both of them made very compelling statements. And they're both right in their own sense because it's an
individual. There is no wrong opinion on that.
I heard both of them like, I hear you. I can see completely both ways.
And totally.
Just, yeah. Let's talk about the moment in court where he stood up. Didn't even really need to stand up other than to be sworn in. But he... That was a creepy moment for me because Ann Taylor, she did her thing. She stood up, did her thing to the judge. And then it was time. Koberger, he was fidgeting. He was like a third grader waiting to stand up. And as I've said, get his participation trophy. And he just couldn't wait. And he stood up without even being asked. And the judge is like, well, while you're up, we'll swear you in, but you can sit down. You're like, you don't need to, I appreciate the respect. I don't think it was an offer of respect on Koberger's part. I think it was Koberger in his own weird sense of, this is the moment I'm about to bask in. And the judge kind of shut that down, like, sit your ass down. But that was weird. Like, it felt like he was really, it wasn't a, you know, shit, I got to say yes. And all, it was like, yes. Like, I am telling you, I did this. What was your take on Koberger's demeanor in that moment of admitting his guilt, name by name, charge by charge?
The one word that I came up with during my live, which I think is the perfect word for it, is chilling.
Yeah.
It was fucking chilling to watch it. I had goosebumps in the worst type of way, goosebumps from watching it, because we just don't see that.
No.
You don't see it, Tony. Like you don't see a dude like, and it goes to everything that we've been saying about his mindset and his personality and where he's at mentally with this thing. It was chilling to the bone, man. Yeah. Like it was like, this was a killer who just stood up without an ounce of remorse. And we'll see during sentencing, he's going to have the opportunity to say something. Like, that's going to be fucking fascinating to see if he's going to say something and what he's going to say, you know, and it's going to be probably one of the most devastating things that we're ever going to watch is those families get up there and get to say their piece as to how this man destroyed the fabric of their lives in a way that's so fucking profound that it's like, It's hard to imagine. It's unimaginable, really.
That's going to be a really tough one to listen to.
Oh, dude, I'm going to be crying like a fucking baby. Yeah. Like, Gary, like, one of the most powerful things that I've seen, like, when you watch these victim impact statements from, like, the school shootings and the aftermath of that, man, like, when I watched, what's-his-face, the kid who they charged the parents, I covered it. I can't believe I came up. The kid where they charged the two parents, they were the first chair. Like, what's his name?
I know what you're talking about. I can picture the kid. Yeah.
It'll come to me as I'm speaking. It's my age. But when I watched those victim impact statements, man, and it was like, it was one after another, and it was family, and it was friends, and it was like the eloquence of some of those kids that stood up and explained how it impacted them was some of the most powerful words I've ever heard.
Yeah.
And I imagine that that day on July 23rd is going to be a lot like that. And you're going to hear it all.
Yeah.
You're going to hear just rage. You're going to hear absolute sorrow, the deepest sorrow. I mean, it's like, and it's so important for us to hear that because it makes it real to us, because it's one thing to sit and watch shit on a TV, but to have even an inkling of what that might feel like if it were your family that was impacted is important for all of us. And it really, it kind of puts into focus, you know, just how devastating these cases really are.
Yeah. It's going to be something to watch. They didn't make it a requirement in the plea deal that he had to say anything at all. So he may not say a word. I think a lot of us are, our mind are going back to BTK when he did a very similar thing to this right before trial, saying, yep, I'm going to plea. And then stood there for 45 minutes and methodically laid out everything he did for all those years. I wonder if we are going to see something like that here, or if this is, you know, they're very different cases. BTK was active for decades. Koberger, this, far as we know, was his first run at a horrible, horrible thing. BTK, I think, had a level of the grandiose and was proud of his years of evil. Koberger had a little sliver of evil in his life that did a lot of damage in a very short period of time. So I'm wondering if he's going to have the gumption to stand up and say what he did. If he wants to, if he will, if that's like a moment of joy for him, of being able to express that, or if it's, he's just going to stand silent like he did when they asked him, you know, did you do this? Guilty, not guilty.
That's not when that happens. So that statement of allocution the defendant can give is typically at sentencing.
I know you wouldn't do it back then by any means, but I'm just saying.
No, I know exactly what you're saying. I just wanted to be clear that the time for pleading is exactly what they did, pleading factual basis by the state.
I know.
When we get to the sentencing, that's when we get that question answered. Sure. Will he give a statement? Will he turn around to the families and apologize, or will he stand up and
just listen.
Say nothing, man? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, if our theme is correct, if what we think about this guy is correct, I'd be stunned if he doesn't say something. Mm-hmm. I don't anticipate that he's going to turn around and show any empathy to the families. I'd be stunned if he did that. Because, I mean, like, that's what I'm saying. This guy's broken. And like, he's not normal. He's not a normal person. There's something just
does he
intrinsically
want people to
damaged
know
in his mind, man.
Does he want people to know his secrets, quote unquote, you know, or is that, does he want to have some of this still in the vest? I mean, almost like BTK till, I mean, he's not dead yet, but he's on death's door, you know, up until now, he's still like doing little riddles here and there because he wants to have people look at him in infamy and wonder what else you got. The fact that Koberger has been called out on everything, going, look at all the dumb things you did in this case. I don't know. It's a weird look into a mind that none of us are ever truly going to understand.
Yeah. And I have to think, I mean, he doesn't ever want to become irrelevant.
No.
You know, like I firmly believe that. I really, it's like, hearing that when Huerman got snatched up, that him and BTK became pen pals, you know, like talking about prison food and what it's like. I think that, and I will not be shocked when we come to find out that other monsters have now accepted him into their fraternity of evil.
I just get the chills.
They're pen paling each other and writing each other. So, yeah, I mean, we'll see how it plays out, man. I mean, it's like, I want to hear what I want to hear being said to the families. I really don't give a fuck about the rest of what he has to say.
Yeah.
The only thing that I care about hearing is some kind of remorse, which I know he doesn't feel.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
He's not like, capable of it. That's the thing.
He doesn't live in him.
Even if he wanted to feel it, he can't. And I think he knows that. And that's no matter how much we want that, it's not the, the analogy I make is like, it's like saying to someone who's blind, well, just look, read a little closer. Like, I'm blind. No, just look at the text. It's right. Let me blow it up for you. They can't see.
Can't see.
It's just not there.
Can't see. It's not, it doesn't exist.
It's a sense that doesn't exist.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, all we know is that if he were to do that, we'd all be talking about how disingenuous it appeared. You know what I mean?
Because it would be emulating like behavior.
But people have a more like a morbid curiosity. Like we all want to try to understand why.
Yeah.
You know, and it's one of those questions that sometimes, short of AI figuring it out,
sometimes we're never there just know. Is no why. There just is no why. So here we are. Brian Koberger has confessed to the unthinkable, and yet it feels like the story is far from over, because while the legal boxes are checked, the emotional ones, they're still gaping wide open. There's no closure for the families, no real answers for the rest of us. Just a man who stood up in court, owned the worst thing imaginable, and sat back down like he'd just finished reciting a menu. Bob said it best. This wasn't cathartic. It was chilling. And the most unsettling part, Koberger looked comfortable, like this moment wasn't the breakdown of control, but a reclaiming of it. After years of strategy, motions, failed defenses, and media obsession, he finally got to say the words on his terms, in his way, with all eyes on him. And as we move forward toward sentencing, the biggest question isn't just whether Koberger will speak again, it's whether we want him to. Because let's be real, if he doesn't talk, or if he does talk, it won't be to comfort the families or take responsibility. It'll be to control the narrative, to stay in the spotlight, to feed whatever fractured thing inside him needed to kill in the first place. It's where the justice system hits a wall. Because we can lock him up, take away his freedom, remove him from society, but we can't stop the attention. We can't make him irrelevant. And for someone like Koberger, that might be the only thing that never mattered. Not freedom, not remorse, just infamy. And maybe that's the hardest part for the families. Not just the loss, not just the horror. But knowing the man who took everything from them may never feel a second of regret, and worse, may enjoy what's coming next. So we watch, we listen, and we brace ourselves for sentencing. Because if Koberger speaks again, it won't be for them. It won't be for us. It'll be for him and him alone.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Brian Koberger.
What's really disturbing, that last piece there on the intro, if you're watching this, you know what I'm talking about. If you're listening to it on the podcast, it was an image of Koberger's bathroom shot with the thumbs up that everybody speculated, going, oh my God, is that real? I mean, it is real, but oh my God, if he killed him, how disturbing is it that shot of him in the bathroom with the thumbs up, what the hell is that? And we speculated early on, like, is this a nod to American Psycho, because he kind of looks like that? The thumbs up is Bundy. The fact it's a shower psycho, there's a lot in that shot. And we had actually thrown it into AI, and it animated it, where he kind of waves his thumb a little bit, and it's pretty haunting and scary. But he did that. He killed those four people, then a few hours later took the shot. 1,000% happened. God. There's a lot of pieces in this, now that we know he's guilty, now that he's admitted his guilt, that are now coming to fruition and are coming to light from earlier chapters in this. And it just kind of blows your mind. Like, oh my God, that they did do it like this. We've all heard chilling phrases. He seems so normal. It's become the unsettling cliche in true crime. The neighbor, the friend, the student who once suspected could not ever commit horrific crimes, but then they do. And the perplexing, deeply troubling saga of Brian Koberger. Ugh. That phrase took center stage yet again, recently echoed by one of the most renowned criminal psychology experts around, Dr. Catherine Ramsland. Ramsland, of course, famous for her close study of serial killers, including the notorious BTK killer. She's been on our show before talking about it. She's been unable to talk about the case against Koberger until now. Yeah. She sat down for a rare and revealing interview with News Nation's Brian Enten to unpack her experiences teaching Brian Koberger directly, back when he was just another eager, intelligent student rather than an infamous accused murderer. During their conversation, Ramsland described a bright, polite student who never raised a single red flag. There were no flashing neon signs that screamed, "Killer in training!" Just a diligent scholar with a fascination for the intricacies of crime, capable of digging into the darkest corners of human psychology without revealing any darkness of his own. But here's the uncomfortable twist. Ramsland herself now openly wonders if Koberger absorbed her teachings about antisocial personalities and criminal minds not as tools for good, but rather it's like a sinister manual, weaponizing knowledge that she hoped would be used to prevent crimes, not be used to commit them. And it's not her fault by any means, because Catherine has inspired thousands of people over the years to do the right thing, to get into criminal justice, to get into the FBI, to get into all sorts of fields and areas of study in this area to do good. By sheer numbers, you're going to have one that slips through the cracks. You're going to have one that's in there for the wrong reasons, and you are not going to be able to identify it. Even the best in the world. Raises an unsettling question we all have to grapple with. Can our best intentions, our best education, inadvertently provide the keys to violence for someone already predisposed to harm? And the answer is yes. But so can the world. He just happened to get really, really close to some of the best. Not a lot of people are able to do that. Let me know your thoughts in the comments as we dive into our conversation here with Siobhan Scott. Comment section is on YouTube, so if you want to join us over there, just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, and you can comment away on our conversation or conversations, because there's a lot of videos. We have hundreds of videos with Siobhan talking about all different cases, and check them out. You'll love it on our YouTube channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. And do hit subscribe there, too, if you don't mind. Really appreciate it. So joining me to unravel this troubling psychological puzzle is psychotherapist Siobhan Scott. Years of experience delving into the darkest corners of the human psyche. Siobhan's going to help us explore the line between fascination and fixation, education and exploitation. Started by asking her the question many of us were pondering, how can someone like Koberger so completely mask their violent intent, even from an expert like Catherine Ramsland herself? Catherine Ramsland finally has broken her silence on this case. She spoke to News Nation's Brian Enten just the other night about what she could on the case. There are still things she can't talk about because of, I forget the term, but it's like HIPAA almost for teachers and students, where there's certain things you can't discuss. But she was able to talk about her her interaction somewhat with her feelings about him. And she came out and said there really wasn't any red flags for the most part. He seemed very much as a student of hers that he was very astute, very polite, very interested, very passionate, had the mental capacity to really get into the information that they were studying and contextualize it and dig deep into it. You know, I wasn't expecting her to be like, he was eager to kill and then just learned how to fly the plane up and not fly it down. It wasn't like that. What do you take? Are you surprised by that at all? Or is that kind of what you would think that this person would have been like if you were to look back on this retrospectively as if he had been a student or when he was a student?
Yeah, his craziness, his dark side, all occurred internally in his head. I think even though people thought he was weird, nobody would have guessed he had the kind of violent fantasies that he had. And so a person like this is very good at compartmentalizing, at keeping it buttoned up, and playing a very polite, appropriate role, certainly with a teacher who's an authority figure.
Yeah, that's the interesting part of this. And I remember we had the conversation earlier on about Howard Bloom has the article out where he theorized, did he do all of this in some crazy way to try and impress Catherine. Catherine had mentioned something yesterday with Brian Enten about it, you know, being a little bit concerned looking back, you know, did he use what he was taught about, you know, the antisocial personality end of things, about how to plan a crime, how to investigate a crime? You know, is this someone who used that for all the wrong reasons? Not that it's something that should necessarily discourage her, but she did bring up, you know, we hope that most people that go through this, they come out the other side and they are going to go use this for good. They're going to go be investigators. They're going to go work in law enforcement, investigative work, whatever have you. But every once in a while, you know, there's going to be someone that comes through like this and uses it for the wrong reasons. When he set out to go down this path as being educated in criminal justice, do you think this was the goal? Was this a long-term goal of Koberger's when he went down that road?
I have said that from the beginning, that there's a certain percentage of people who study criminology, forensic science, because they want to learn how to be a better criminal and how to get away with that. You even see that sometimes in people who become law enforcement officers. It's like, you know, now I've got the power here. How can I wield this? How can I get away with it? How can I satiate my desire for beating people up and being a violent person? That's not the majority, but you do get people who go into it for the wrong reasons, and it's often not picked up if they're a good psychopath.
Yeah, clearly. What do you think is going through his mind right now? Is this genuine remorse that he, for what he did, and now he's finally coming out, or is this the... I got caught, and as we talked earlier, it's this very mechanical thinking.
I think it's very mechanical. I don't think he's capable of remorse. Anybody capable of remorse would not have done a crime like this. My God, you know, how awful. Four sleeping college students. This guy doesn't have a conscience. He simply doesn't. I think his only remorse is that he left the damn knife sheath behind. He's probably perseverated on that one every day since.
Is this... another thing we had talked about for a long time, is this part of him basically getting what he wanted at the end of the day? He is now infamous. He is now up there with the likes of Bundy and the likes of BTK and all of that. And obviously in his normal life, he was a very, average dude for the most part, or less than, This is the one thing that he seemed to have grasped onto and feel in his mind that he was great at. Mm-hmm. Obviously not so much, but he's now in that chair, and he's now going to be studied. He's going to be interviewed. You know, who knows what he might do? He might write a book or something. He can't profit off of this. There's laws against that, but it doesn't mean he couldn't become someone who speaks and is studied. Even Catherine Ramsland just said with Brian Enten, she'd be interested in studying him and sitting down and talking with him and trying to get a grasp on how his thought processes worked. Do you think that's part of this? Do you think this is just, okay, he's making the best of whatever situation comes his way, and now he gets to be infamous?
100%. I think that... it was very, in large part, I mean, there were multiple reasons that he had these fantasies, but I think the fantasy of being a grandiose murderer in the leagues of Bundy and BTK, I think all along that was his goal. And there's a part of him that's enjoying it still, even, you know, four life sentences. He's never going to be out again. In his mind, it was worth it to be a person who will never be forgotten.
Is it, what can we glean? What can be learned from someone like Koberger, from someone who psychologically is going to study him, like a Catherine Ramsland? What are we looking for when we're looking at this retrospectively? Someone who has said, yep, I did it. Obviously, we can hear about his planning. We can hear about the logistics of what was done. But are we going to ever... this is one guy. Are there clues? Are there cues? Are there things we can learn from his behavior that can help prevent this in other potential Kobergers out there that pop up every now and then? What can be gleaned by studying him further?
It's a really hard one. I mean, we're, you know, can we dissect brains? You know, I don't think we're very good at the neuroscience of this yet. There are indications that people that commit crimes like this that are extremely psychopathic, their brains are different. They came out of the chute different. And can we hope to understand that better in, you know, someday in some way? Definitely. I don't know if the science is there yet. But it's hard to look at the behavior and say, oh, well, here were red flags, because there are lots of weird guys out there. There are lots of guys that are stilted, awkward, don't know how to relate to women, can come off as offensive at times. But there really wasn't anything that would have stood out in this case that said this guy is going to become a mass murderer. We just, I don't think we can spot those things.
I mean... Short of doing brain scans, which, you know, I don't see that being anytime soon, but who knows? You know, and even if you were to look at that, I mean, there has been research done and such that does look at some serial killers, and their brains do look a little bit different to a certain extent. But you can also find people who are not serial killers who have brains that are very similar as well.
Every brain has differences. And and we do, from the studies with functional magnetic imagery, we do see that the brains of psychopaths have a very different structural connections between the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex. That's the empathy center. But a lot of people who do not become violent have brains like that. And we know that many psychopathic people go into politics and achieve great success or become salesmen and are very successful. So it's not like we can, you know, brain scan everybody in the country and go, oh, let's designate the psychopaths here. So we've still got a lot to learn, a lot to work out. And certainly there are red flags. If you've got a young boy fascinated with violent pornography, that's of concern. You want to get that kid into treatment. If you've got a kid that's harming animals, especially, you know, dogs and cats, not just hunting or things like that, but animals that most of us bond with, if they're cruel to animals, that's a red flag. But I don't know that we saw those things with him, you know, and there can be all kinds of hidden things about him that nobody ever saw. So if he were to be studied further by someone like Catherine Ramsland or others, I hope that we can glean some information on, are there other ways we can intervene with people earlier in life?
As we close out this unnerving conversation with psychotherapist Siobhan Scott, I keep coming back to one haunting question. How does someone so outwardly ordinary conceal such profound darkness, even from experts whose life work is understanding exactly that kind of darkness? They do. Because they do. Because they can. And because we're human. Because Catherine is human. It seems sometimes these folks are not. Catherine Ramsland's unsettling realization that a student she mentioned might have twisted her lessons on criminal psychology into a how-to guide for violence highlights a sobering reality about the limitations of human perception. We often confront ourselves by thinking evil wears a recognizable face. What happens when the face of danger blends in with everyday life hiding in plain sight? As Siobhan so eloquently reminded us, true psychopathy often doesn't announce itself with glaring warning signs. Instead, it moves quietly, learning, observing, calculating its next move in silence. It forces us to rethink how we recognize danger, to accept the uncomfortable truth that there may never be an exact roadmap for spotting a killer in training. Yet, as we've discussed today, perhaps the real value of studying someone like Koberger isn't just about understanding him. It's about learning how to prevent the next Koberger from slipping through the cracks. Can educators, psychologists, and law enforcement better screen or guide those who become too fixated on the darkness? Or must we accept that certain minds will always find ways to weaponize knowledge no matter how closely we watch? One thing is clear. Brian Koberger's story forces us to reckon with complexities we'd rather avoid, challenging our comfortable assumptions about who poses a threat and why. Ah, they're fine. They're just a little off. And as Catherine Ramsland herself continues wrestling with what she could have missed, We're reminded that when it comes to human psychology, even the experts can be fooled. Until next time, keep your eyes open and don't underestimate what might be lurking right in front of you. Again, comment section on YouTube. Search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Tell us what your thoughts are on this conversation. We do greatly appreciate it. And please do hit subscribe as well. Helps us grow the channel, and we always appreciate your input. Even an option there now for you, too. If you want to comment before everybody else, you can become a member of our YouTube channel and subscribe and get access to everything before everybody else and binge away. It's nice. It's there for you, ad-free as well. So check that out when you become a paying subscriber. But you can subscribe for free. You can get it all in your feed, and you can comment for free, too. But if you want that extra perk, the advanced and the way to speak early, that's there for you. We do greatly appreciate it if you can become a member. Until next time, for all of us here, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.